and welcome. You're tuned into the best in true crime talk radio. This is True Crime Tuesday. I'm your host, Dave Schrader, along with me, Tim Dennis. Hello, Tim.
Hello there.
Hey, this is exciting. This week, we're off in Gettysburg. So if you are interested in the strange, the supernatural, true crime, we're going to be out in Gettysburg at the Eisenhower Hotel at Phenom 2020. It is the premier event. It'll be taking place out all weekend. It starts Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday. Tickets are still on sale at phenom2020.com, or they'll have tickets for sale at the door. So come on out, visit with us. I'll be there with Tim Dennis. I'll also be there with Shane Pittman from the Holzer Files. There's a lot of great guests that are going to be there. For more information, you can check out phenom2020.com. Or go to our website at darknessevents.com to find out more information about that. Tim, I also want to make a quick mention. This Thursday, we do not have a live video stream.
Yep.
We did that last night.
Right.
Because we're going to be out in Gettysburg. We did an interesting interview last night. Justin Loop and Stormy Daniels were our guests. And we talked about their interest and foray into the paranormal. That will be available as a podcast on Friday, or you can go check out our Darkness Radio YouTube page for the live video that we recorded last night. Let's get started. You know, I love, Tim, when we're able to re-examine a case that we've covered in the past from a different angle.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, this is a cousin of yours that reached out to me and said, hey, have you ever spoken to Dr. Daniel Friedman about his book, The Strange Case of Dr. Doyle? And I said, no, go on. And she gave me a little synopsis of it. And I knew that this was something that interested me enough to want to re-examine this case. So let's dive into this. Again, we've done many different stories on Jack the Ripper on the show.
Yep.
From Neil Story talking about Bram Stoker's connection to creating Dracula because of Jack the Ripper, to even our good buddy Jeff Mudgett, who believes his great-great-great-grandfather, H.H. Holmes, may in fact be the Ripper. Well, today joining us is Dr. Daniel Friedman. He's the author, co-author of a book called The Strange Case of Dr. Doyle, A Journey into Madness and Mayhem. Dr. Friedman, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Dave, and thank you, Tim, for having me today.
So, obviously, there's been so many different theories on the Ripper, and everybody seems to have a favorite horse in this race, and there's a wide variety of different names associated, and even Lewis Carroll, the author of Alice in Wonderland's name, has been bandied about from time to time as a potential suspect. Could you talk to us a little bit about, again, just for people that apparently are brand new and just born a week ago and have no clue about the Ripper case, can you give us a little background on the Ripper case? And then I'd like to look at some of the more popular suspects and then talk a little bit about the theory that you've evolved.
Sure. I'm going to start with just giving you a brief history of the Ripper crimes. The file actually starts back in April of 1888, where a mutilation was taking place and with stabbings, and the victim died later on. But that's where the case file opens, but they don't believe that's the first of what they call the canon. The canon of the Ripper file begins in August of 1888, and that is where I'm going to start all this. So in 1888, we have our first murder that was carried out on the streets of London, in the East End. This is the area where a lot of the prostitutes would live and frequent, the poor or those who were in the trades would live. And in Darkness Without a Scream, you found a woman in her 40s who was mutilated. Her neck was slashed and her belly was slashed. And again, a couple of weeks later, 9 days later, another woman was found, very similar neck wounds, abdominal wounds, more mutilations were occurring. And then again, at the end of September, two more murders took place. So this is what we consider the beginning of the Jack the Ripper's crime spree. And it took place really within a month's period. And that's in the summer and the early fall of 1888.
Now, these murders, Dr. Friedman, to kind of help people understand them, was it believed at the time this was the work of one person? I mean, the area in the Whitechapel district was a seedy area, to say the least. There was a lot
Yeah, murders took place every day in this area, or garroting, or yeah, exactly. All this is a seedy place, exactly. But the way this person conducted themselves, and the way the escapes that were done, they really thought this was the work of one person. And believe it or not, some people, as you mentioned before, we have H.H. Holmes as a candidate, and we have the Queen. When I was a kid, I actually thought it was the Queen's Royal Physician. And I based that on this TV movie I watched in the 80s, which Michael Caine was like Sir William Gull. So when I actually was conducting my original research into Sir Arthur Conan Doyle and came across this Ripper crime, my first impression was that William Gull was Jack the Ripper. But when I did some research into William Gull, I found that he was 72 years old at the time and had suffered a stroke just a few months prior, which left him paralyzed on his dominant side. So he would be running around the streets, age 72, carrying his arm so it wouldn't be flapping. Then he would have to subdue women that were, these were prostitutes. These were tough street women. They would fight you. They would hurt you. I mean, these were not just, you know, the socialites of London. So when I really thought about this 72-year-old man trying to fight these women, remember, they didn't make a scream. They were not able to scream, these women. No call was made for help. I just said, this guy cannot be. He's had a stroke. He's 72, and they were conducted at nighttime. Very difficult to see at night, especially doing very surgically precise mutilations. So he was one of the people I immediately exonerated from being Jack. And the other one you actually mentioned before was H.H. Holmes or Mudgett. They're both the same person. And it's actually, he's the person that I would like to actually use to discuss Doyle's connection to the Whitechapel murders to this Chicago serial killer, because the modus operandi was completely different for the two of them. We have H.H. Holmes, who was carrying out his evil deeds for financial gain. You know, he was looking for money. As a matter of fact, he would put out what was seemingly legitimate employment advertisements in local newspapers, and then people would apply, he would accept them. Right. He would take out large insurance policies on them, and Nathan himself, the sole beneficiary. And then when he killed them, it wasn't just a quick kill. He derived pleasure from hearing their screams. Like, he would poison them with toxic gas. He would seal them in airtight vaults. I mean, he made himself a castle with fake doors that led to nowhere with brick walls. And he conducted his activities indoors in the protection of his own castle. I mean, the police weren't going to find him doing these things. Jack the Ripper was a different character. He didn't do his murders for money. I mean, these were prostitutes, you know, they were penniless. And they were all selected. They were all in their 40s, the women that Jack picked. All prostitutes in their 40s. And Jack didn't care if he was going to get caught or not. He did his crimes out in the open streets. These streets were busy. I mean, yeah, they were midnight or 1 a.m., but in the third murder, he was outside of the social club. The club was having an active meeting. He actually killed the victim right at the door. So if anybody walked in or out, they would have seen him conducting his business. So, and one of the murders, murder number four, that of Catherine Eddowes, he was in the darkest corner of Mitre Square. And when the police came, he was still there. He was hiding out. He had to wait for the police to leave before he could flee the scene. But if the police would have confronted him, you got a picture. This guy, the Ripper, would have fought for the police officer. So you got a picture. This guy has a lot of strength, reckless abandon, courage. I mean, this guy is ready to put up a fight with the police. So I consider the motive behind and the MO of H.H. Holmes completely different from that of Jack. And for any of the members of law enforcement out there who are listening or fans of Dexter, MOs of serial killers are not subject to change. that's how like a good detective will actually bring a serial killer into justice. It just doesn't. I exonerated H.H. Holmes from this killing, not the ones he did in Chicago.
Well, the thought behind, I know Holmes' concept was that Holmes was a hyper-intelligent man. He loved the challenge. He loved all of this. Changing the M.O. would be something that would keep an intelligent man free, right? I mean, you change the brutality or change the modus operandi, but the brutality remains the same. Vicious, brutal, and... I don't know. There's just so many different aspects of this.
Well, you got to remember, though, that the method of execution used by H.H. Holmes was not more of a brute force. It was more of the torture devices, the poison gas, watching them die from lack of oxygen. He butchered them up, yes. He mutilated them, but he did that more like, I don't know if you guys know the story of Burke and Hare from Edinburgh. They were the body snatchers.
Right.
He would chop up his victims' bodies and sell their body parts to medical schools. It's very similar to that of Burke and Hare. The Ripper, on the other hand, would, and you got a picture. This is a person who has power because he took a woman of the night. He had to strangle them, you know, to make sure their hearts weren't beating, then slit their throats and then mutilate them in the streets and then put back on their dresses in one of the victims and then get out of there in 5 minutes. I mean, you need power and you need to be able to say, I don't care if anybody finds me, I can fight myself off. I don't think H.H. Holmes would have, even if he changed the MO per se, I don't think he had the other parts that... the natural bellicosity, the brute power and strength that the Ripper must have had. I mean, the two just don't match. And as a matter of fact, the person I spoke to actually from a communication on email, Eric Lawson, he wrote the book Devil in the White City. He tried, if I remember correctly, to connect the Ripper with H.H. Holmes, and he wasn't able to do so. He said it would have been great for book sales, but it just didn't fit. He wasn't in the right place at the right time.
Now, there was another doctor, I believe, that was considered a candidate, a suspect in this. And this guy, I want to say he was like German or Austrian or something. Do you know who I'm referring to?
Well, there was a Dr. Neil Cream. Now, he's a little bit different because when he was on the gallows, he actually poisoned four prostitutes in London. But the problem was when he was on and they caught him. But when they put him to the gallows, he actually yelled out, I am Jack, or I am. And he was, or, I am Jack, but he didn't get to the Ripper. But his address during the Whitechapel crimes was the Illinois State Penitentiary. He tried to kill someone with strychnine back in America, and he got caught. So that doctor was exonerated from the Ripper crimes. He did his time for the other four prostitutes he killed, but not for the London prostitutes of 1888.
All right. Now, you've talked about some of these different suspects in this crime. Obviously, you know, when you've got all these names and so many different people, from the Queen's physicians to, I believe, even one of the royal family themselves, you know, Lewis Carroll is a fringe person, you know, doctors, butchers, bakers, candlestick makers, right? It seems like everybody at one point was under this umbrella of scrutiny, I'm sure, simply because we wanted to feel like we had some handle on this and that law enforcement might actually be onto something. But it was, you know, I think it's been proven time and time again, their sloppy methodology of trying to collect evidence and examining this case was so beyond basic. It's ridiculous. How do you start separating the fact from fiction? Like I said, there's so many books about each individual that has believed to been a suspect, and they will make a very compelling story for each one. How do you go in and look at this and deconstruct their theories and stories to realize there's no way this person could be? Obviously, you had a good point at the one, you know, onset with the Queen's physician being too old and having suffered a stroke and unable to
exactly
use half of his body. So that makes sense. But, you know, in each one of these different cases, did you go through and look at each one individually and chip away at the base of the story that was built up around them?
You know, on a lot of them I did. You have to find You know, when I first wrote the book, I got to admit, I tried to stick only to firsthand evidence, you know, involving Jack the Ripper, avoiding books like Patricia Cromwell's books and other people's books based on theories about who Jack could be. I had to actually go back and make sure that I picked the right person and looked at their evidence and said, what do they have that's right and wrong? One of them that I did like was Patricia Cromwell's theory about Walter Sickert, who was an English impressionist. He was he caught the attention of Ripperologists back in like the 1970s. There was a painting he did titled What We Shall Do, or something like What We Shall Do to Pay the Rent. And it depicted this indoor butchering, supposedly, of Jack the Ripper of killing Mary Jane Kelly. You know, he's like, the guy's sitting at the bed, he looks sorry. The woman's naked with her head turned. And she was very impressed, Patricia Cromwell. So she actually bought the painting. And if I remember correctly, she tried to like rip it apart and study the DNA fragments. She was also very impressed by the paper used by the Ripper, this brand of Peary paper, which she said was like this artist-grade paper. Very few people would have used it, and Sickert would have been the one to have it. So here I am with my own thing going, oh my God, if I can't connect my suspect to this Peary paper, I got an empty theory here. So I actually read a book called Pathology of it's a pathology book, and it was written by William Rutherford, who happened to be a professor of Arthur Conan Doyle. And he's actually the model for Professor Challenger in The Lost World. I don't know if your readers, you know, your audience may know that, but Doyle wrote a book called The Lost World, and there was a right. Professor Challenger. And that Professor Challenger is actually based on this Professor Rutherford. Now, in this book on page 9, Rutherford actually states, and this is what I needed to find. He says to his students, you must use the smooth but not too highly glazed antique notepaper made by Peary and Sons out of Aberdeen, Scotland. Now, Doyle not only was a student of William Rutherford's, but he also worked in the clandestine vivisection lab that Rutherford was operating. Very interesting here. In that lab, the experiment that Rutherford was working on was you would cut the windpipe of the dogs, of the canine, to be, remember, they were alive. They were anesthetized with curare. So they were still alive. They felt pain, but they couldn't move. So you would cut the windpipe of the dogs, and then you would cannulate. You put tubes into the liver. So if there's anybody out there who's a Ripper fan or a Ripper aficionado knows all the information, Catherine Eddowes, murder number 4, if you remember correctly, not only did she have her neck sliced, so the windpipe cut, but her liver was, there were holes poked in her liver. So the Ripper actually took liver samples home with them from that crime scene, very akin to the experiments done in Professor Rutherford's lab.
Okay, that's weird.
Yeah.
So many of these crimes, obviously, they're so brutal in nature. And how many? Is there 5 canonical, what they believe to be canonical?
There are 5 canonical, but actually a lot of people like myself believe there were only 4. And the 5th one, the one that was the indoor one that the picture was of
Jane Kelly,
Richard Cromwell likes. Yeah. They actually don't believe that was done by the Ripper. I actually had that in my book, too. I didn't look at the evidence that the people found, but I thought that the one of her boyfriends who had the fight with her and punched a hole through her glass window came back and basically killed her and executed her in this very, very disordered conductly fashion. Like, you know, the blood was splashed all over the walls, and the Ripper didn't do any of that. You know, the Ripper killed you outdoors. He didn't need to bring you indoors. He didn't have blood splashed all over the place. He waited for your heart to be stopped. This other person just kind of slit her throat and said, oh, why don't I just keep going and do all the other parts? So they don't really match up that way either. The MOs were kind of off. And other people found that too. It wasn't just me.
Right. I know there's been a lot of question regarding that. But I thought the other concept of that was, you know, for the first time, he had time. He had an explosion. He had something that would allow him to get even more gruesome.
Yeah, but you got to remember, every murder he did with a purpose. I don't think he didn't need time, and he didn't need good lighting. I mean, here's, as we mentioned before, the 4th murder was conducted in the darkest part of Mitre Square, no escape route. It was closed in. The Ripper didn't care if it was light or dark. He operated in pure darkness, and it didn't affect him. As a matter of fact, that fourth murder, and these are the things that look more surgical to me. In the darkness of this corner, he did an abdominal incision where he encircled the belly button. He did a navel flap. That's something that we, you know, surgeons do in the operating room. We don't cut like a butcher straight down the middle, you know, go from the, you know, your zipper process down to your pubis. We actually make a flap around your belly button. The Ripper did that procedure. It is not something that you would do if you were just trying to kill someone. You would slash right down the middle, not the Ripper. He had time to do this. And as I said, he poked holes in the liver, and he did facial mutilations, very detailed facial mutilations on that victim in the darkness. He also planted a thimble next to that victim's finger. So we had time to do this too for the arrangement. And these things have a purpose. I mean, one of the things I found out, or I discovered, I guess you would call it, is that thimble actually is symbolic. And I don't know if some of your audience members would probably be Disney fans. And if you are,
sure.
In Peter Pan, which was written by J.M. Barrie, who actually was a good friend of Arthur Conan Doyle. They played on the same cricket team, and they actually wrote a play together. In Peter Pan, Wendy gives, there's an exchange with a thimble and an acorn. I think Wendy gives Peter Pan a thimble, which represents is symbolic of a kiss.
Right.
And here you have rings being taken off fingers at the murder sites, handkerchiefs being left at the crime scene. In all the inquests, there was always a discussion was, did this handkerchief belong to the victim? And they didn't. These victims were not the owners of it. So whoever was their murderer actually left handkerchiefs behind. And this thimble left near the finger of Catherine Eddowes. So handkerchiefs also are symbolic. They are found in Shakespeare's Othello, where Desdemona is manipulated by Iago, and with the handkerchiefs, it shows infidelity to Othello. So these handkerchiefs were symbols of infidelity. The thimble was a symbol of a kiss, which was taken away from the finger. It wasn't on the finger, but away. And the rings, which are symbolic of eternal love, were taken from the crime scene. So here's a really brilliant serial killer who's leaving clues behind in the form of symbols. And those three symbols are very important to the nature of Jack the Ripper to me, but it shows the intelligence of who is the man behind the killings.
But here's the thing then. Okay, here would be my skeptical side of that. When we use the word brilliant killer, right, and brilliant criminal, why would he leave clues behind? This isn't a Batman comic book, right, with the Riddler and Joker leaving tips to where they're going to strike next. Why would he tip off or attempt to tip off law enforcement?
I think some serial killers enjoy the chase, that little game. They like to show that they are one step ahead of them, and they're not going to be apprehended. Even when they think they have them, they're always going to outwit the other people. And I think this killer himself knew he was that smart and that good, and he was leaving very cryptic. These are not common. You know, I don't think I've ever seen in the literature, like the symbol of the thimble or the handkerchief. The rings are probably, and I haven't seen it myself, but I'm sure the rings would mention that signs of infidelity. But I think he was showing the police that he was doing these crimes. You're not going to catch me, but I did it for an act of revenge, and it was for infidelity or against someone or someone I loved. And I think that was the message that the Ripper was leaving behind. There was a motive. I mean, if you ask most of the people that discuss the Ripper with you, when you ask what was his motive, I don't think anybody really will give you a motive or show you with to hold in there. I have a piece. This is what his motive was about. I'm actually certain that the Ripper was smart enough to know he was going to show the police these were my motives. It was for revenge. Something bad happened to me that was from these women, these prostitutes in this 40 age range, not the woman that I'm killing, but a group, 40-year-old prostitutes did something bad to me, And that is why I'm out on the streets killing them.
All right. Well, here's my question then for you. And I'm curious what your thoughts are on this. If you are a prolific murderer who believes you're hyper-intelligent and above the law and can tease the law, you want to kind of leave your name, you want to be recognized for it, why not leave a message? Why not leave a deathbed confession as a big middle finger to law enforcement saying, you morons, I laid it out for you. How could you not have picked up? I would think that that would have been the final slap in the face for the Ripper to screw with law enforcement. Why was there never an official admission from a true potential candidate for this crime or series of crimes?
You know, Dave, I'm going to tell you what you're saying to me is exactly what triggered me to investigate my suspect. And I'm going to tell you what happened. When I was a medical student, we're talking, this is 25 years ago, I was in the library reading Scientific America. And there was an article about the Piltdown hoax. This article, I didn't write it, but it was a masterpiece article about this big giant hoax that was played on the entire intellectual community of Great Britain. They said they found a skull in the pit down, Piltdown, the sand pits and the gravel, and it was the missing link. A couple of years later, it was discovered there was nothing more than an orangutan and an old human skull. And someone had chiseled down the bones. The investigators of this article said that the person most likely to be the perpetrator of the Piltdown hoax was no other than Arthur Conan Doyle. And I said, oh my God, this guy went to his grave. This is exactly what you were saying. Went to his grave and never confessed that he did this and destroyed the reputations of two men. One was dead at the time, but another one who was still living, destroyed the reputations of two men just to get revenge on a guy named Ray Lancaster. And I said, what kind of person is this that would do this? He should have left a deathbed confession at least to say, hey, you know, that's the thing I did over in Piltdown, I made that up. And it was, but no confession on that either. And that's one of the pieces that made me start looking at this and trying to find out all these little pieces about Arthur Conan Doyle's life. So the way you just said that to me is exactly what made me investigate Doyle in the first place.
Well, and the book kind of is this interesting walk along this tour of the Whitechapel murders, but it's also a biography. And we do have a link for the book in today's program guide.
I really appreciate that.
Now, talk to us a little bit about this this correlation and how you kind of unravel Doyle's life. Because, again, people are looking at this man, and I want people to realize, too, I mean, obviously we've talked a lot about Doyle and Houdini and their friendship through the years. We've talked a lot about the high strangeness of this man that wrote one of the most analytical, thinking, scientifically principled detectives in history, but yet he believed in fairies and all aspects of the paranormal, even when proven wrong by Houdini. He was a staunch advocate for these mediums of the time. So we've got this guy who's, you know, kind of looked at and revered and in some instances heckled for his fallible nature to the fantastical side. How do you start tying him in? And what was the first flag that popped up to you that made you think, huh, I wonder if Doyle knew more about this murder than anybody knew or expected? What was that initial moment for you?
You know, what I'm going to tell you is I actually didn't investigate Doyle to investigate the Ripper crimes. I actually did it, as I mentioned before, the first thing was the article I read in Science Magazine of the Piltdown hoax. And then maybe about a week or two later, another article came out. I think it was in JAMA. It's another one of those medical journals I get. And it was about Arthur Conan Doyle, age 29, setting off to Germany to attend a lecture by basically the top scientific investigator of his time, Robert Koch. He did Koch's postulates. He breaks into the guy's lab because he can't attend the lecture, although he tried to without a ticket. Tries to get in, can't get in. He breaks into his special lab, goes through all of his notes, finds out that this stuff doesn't really look legit, goes back to England and breaks the story that Koch's research is basically false and it is not a cure for tuberculosis. And all I could think to myself at the time was, oh my God, the guy's 29 years old. He just embarrassed the greatest scientific mind of all time in the press. And Doyle turned out to be right, which is the amazing part. But it was then that I basically set out to learn everything I could about Arthur Conan Doyle as a young man. And even before he was even a writer, I wanted to know what made this guy tick, where he came from, what he had accomplished at this time in his life, and where his life was headed. And believe it or not, the stuff I found about his early life was blew my mind. I mean, you have a 4-year-old kid who is a great writer. He writes a story about a man-eating tiger. 2 years later, he joins street gangs, and he becomes the champion of it. This is a 6-year-old kid. He becomes the champion in the street gangs. He's fighting older kids. He's blackening kids' eyes. He gets sent off to his father was an alcoholic. A terrible alcoholic and a little bit violent. So the mom sends him away up the block to a friend's house, Mary Burden. Lives there at a 10th school where at the school he goes to, Newington School, he's beaten. He's treated terribly. He's of this dysfunctional family. He's not even living at home. He's being beaten at school. He gets sent away to another school down in the north of England. Same thing happens. As a matter of fact, his students of the school said Doyle was beaten more than any other kid at that school. He was beaten on his hands. His hands are always swollen, bleeding. He was basically tortured, this kid. And I just said, oh, the guy, I felt terrible for what his life was. I mean, as a physician, you got to remember, I'm a pediatrician, and my job is actually to follow the growth and development of children into their adolescence and young adulthood. I mean, I just said, this guy's on a path of destruction. So I keep following him. He goes over to another school in Germany, in Austria, actually. The first day there, he takes out a scissor and he stabs a kid. I was like, this is crazy. You don't do this. It's not how you introduce yourself. Hey, I'm going to stab you with the bed scissors in your chest.
Right.
I'm like, hello. I mean, there's something wrong here. I mean, then he goes back to Edinburgh, attends med school. There he starts learning, really perfecting the art of boxing. He has a crazy friend, George Budd. They fight with each other. They're both crazy nuts, the two of them, doing crazy experiments. They were actually working in the liver lab with Rutherford. Doyle then takes a year off, goes up to the Arctic as a ship's physician. So this is a medical school. This is very common back in the 1880s. You're a third-year student. You go on a boat. You say you're the ship's surgeon. While there, the first day on the boat, he challenges the purser, Jack Lamb, to a fight. And Doyle blackens the guy's eye. And the whole crew gets the respect for Doyle. And they make him a sealer and a hunter. He actually, at this point in his life, is instead of doing the medical job, he's actually doing the carving up of the seals. He's clubbing them in the heads with the clubs and bashing at the seals' eyeballs. I mean, this guy has a little streak that I didn't know about. And this is just, he's only 21 now. He celebrated his 21st birthday at this time. He goes back home later on back to med school. He goes, he sees his mother, and his mom is with this guy, Brian Waller, a lodger, and Doyle beats the lodger up. 3 weeks it takes this guy to recuperate. And this guy cleared out of Edinburgh forever, the guy left. And this is the mother's, was having an affair with this guy, obviously, and she would leave later and join Brian Waller in his estate. But every time I just kept following Doyle's progression, and it's like he comes back to he moves to his new home in Southsea, and he gets off the ferry at Clarence, and he basically beats up a guy in the street. He joins into a fight in the street, and the police start chasing him down, and he runs away. So I just saw this crazy streak, this and a person that I never would have imagined to have this. I mean, I'm thinking of him as Sherlock Holmes and the Lost World and
right.
These wonderful stories. And everything I'm learning about him goes counter to what I know. And the next part was the part that got me to reevaluate again. It's now 1885 to 1887. He is writing his medical school thesis. This is March of 1885. During this time, he takes on a very sick patient by the name of Jack Hawkins. He semi-confesses, you don't really know for sure, but he overdosed the patient with chlorohydrate. The guy dies. He's running his medical school thesis at the time. Guy dies. He arranges for his burial quickly. The police investigate him for his murder, but he gets off the hook because a Freemason doctor basically vouched for Doyle. This is real. This is all true. So Dr. Pike, you know, vouches for Doyle and says he did nothing wrong. Gets off the hook for the murder of his resident lodger, and then he marries the guy's sister. So he winds up marrying this girl, his dead patient's sister. He marries, and he then writes an article at the same time about the retracted Contagious Diseases Act, and this is what got me. So his thesis is on syphilis. And then he writes this article that all prostitutes should be locked up in these lock hospitals where invasive examinations are performed on them until they are deemed free of contagious disease. And he makes this whole thing up, and another doctor writes, says, everything you said was a lie, this guy Dr. Banks, and you better retract for what you said because you are an absolute liar. And Doyle actually made a retraction statement to what he said. And I'm thinking, here's a guy, he's thinking about syphilis, he wrote his thesis on it, yet he has nothing to do with this in his medical history. And he writes an article about locking women up who have syphilis, who are prostitutes. And I said, something is deeply troubling him. I have to find out what it is. And I ordered this book called The Doyle Diary. And I thought it was better, you know, Doyle Diary. Who else is it going to be? It's going to be Arthur Conan Doyle. It wound up being about his father. Yeah. And you think, the great Doyle mystery. And I'm thinking, it's going to be about Arthur Conan Doyle. And it's going to be his diary. No, it was about his father, Charles Doyle, who at age 42 was locked up in a mental asylum and actually lived out the rest of his life incarcerated as a prison in mental asylums. For purportedly for dipsomania, for alcoholism, but he had I needed to know more because usually you dry up and you go home.
Right.
Yeah. So I call up the mental hospitals, Montrose, and I ask for the medical records to be sent to me. They sent them over to me, and upon admission for Charles Doyle is only one physical ailment that he has, an absent knee jerk reflex. And for you and I, you go to the doctor, they hit you in the knee with a reflex hammer and your knee's supposed to bounce. So his doesn't bounce. And I went back to Doyle's thesis, which he wrote in 1885, and it's all about this absent reflex called the Westfall sign. And then Doyle writes, if you have an absent Westfall, absent knee jerk or this Westfall sign, you have syphilis. You know, basically these are his words.
Okay.
And I'm thinking, wait, if Doyle's writing that in his thesis and his father's only finding on admission was the absent knee jerk, then Doyle must have thought his father had syphilis. Now, we don't know if he really did, but Doyle as a medical student would have thought that. And I said, I wonder if Doyle thought he had syphilis too. And at the end of Doyle's thesis, the last thing he does is says he does a confession. He actually says, I've been taking like a toxic dose of Mural solution, which was like a treatment of syphilis at the time, and it's caused no ill effect on me. I said the only explanation which would account for this would be he would be gripped with fear that he had syphilis, and he was trying to prevent himself becoming a victim like his father. You know, he saw his father, age 42, in a mental hospital. I mean, Doyle at the time was 25 years old. He must have thought, oh my God, I only got a couple of years before I'm going to be like my dad. And actually, Doyle wrote a book called The Third Generation, where he writes about a guy who kills himself because he realizes that he has syphilis that was handed down from his grandfather down to him, and that he was an innocent victim, but he wasn't going to go and marry a girl because he knew he would be, like Charles Doyle, locked in a mental hospital and die. So these were some of the things that got me really going, investigating to see what this guy was doing, where he was, what things he was like, what was the experience?
You know what's standing out to me, Dr. Friedman, is the fact that you're right. Here we've got this preconceived notion of Sir Arthur Conan Doyle being this, you know, hyper-intelligent man, this well-versed, well-heeled gentleman who, you know, walked amongst the stars of the time. Right. And was
absolutely
well-spoken,
yeah.
an amazing writer, analytical, everything. And yet the other side is this dark, violent predisposition, it appears.
Exactly. And these are the things that caught me, too. And I said, there's something about him.
Though, if you're doing this and you're reading through this, right, and you're seeing these flags pop up. I mean, how much of a holy beep moment was that for you to start to realize, oh, this isn't the guy I thought I knew?
Yeah, I mean, you're right. The holy moment, even with all of this, that wasn't my smoking gun to myself. You know, that wasn't the one. It was, so now I'm in 1885 and 86, and there's all this stuff about syphilis and all this stuff about his father, and it's all, like, it's coming to me now. There's something going on, but what's the connection? All of a sudden, I read something about the Jack the Ripper crimes, and they thought it was a Freemason that may have been the murderer behind it because of this clue that was left on a wall. And I'm saying, well, the good thing about Arthur Conan Doyle is he's not a Freemason. Now, I read his order. He's not in the autobiography. He's not a Freemason, so he's off the hook. No, in 1887, he joins the Freemasons. So now you're in January, 1887. He joins it. A month later, he becomes a second-degree Mason. A month after that, he becomes a third-degree Mason. So he rose up the ranks rapidly. And all of a sudden, they're celebrating the 100th anniversary of the lodge. They're raising money for the hospital. He distances himself from the organization, like, for no reason. He doesn't show up to the meetings. He already paid his dues. He's got his apron, the whole nine yards. He doesn't show up anymore. After the Ripper crimes end, he demits. And as anybody who's listening on this broadcast, this podcast knows, no one really demits from the Freemasons. It's just something that you don't do. But Doyle did. And I said, what was going on in his, what was he doing? What was he learning? And I didn't want to learn what we learn now in the Freemasons, because that's irrelevant. You have to learn what they were doing back in the time. And in order to become this third degree Master Mason back in the 1880s, and just before, like, a little disclaimer here, the Freemasons are a wonderful organization.
Right.
They do charitable events. They are made up of the leaders of our society. They, even back in the 1880s, kings have held the gavel. You had lawyers, doctors, brewers, bakers, you name it. Even Charles Warren, the commissioner of the police force, was the royal historian of the Freemasons. I mean, you're talking about some very excellent people. So this is like, we know you have a rogue doctor who does bad things. So this is like you have a rogue Freemason. So I'm not talking about the Freemasons as a group did not go out and kill women on the street and do all this. This is just someone who had an issue who happened to be a Freemason and a doctor and a writer. It has nothing to do with the Freemasons. But during his initiation process on that third degree test, he had to learn about, he had to like do a play. That's like about the Master Mason, Hiram Abiff. And this plays about reenacting what we call penal signs. It's like the first sign is like Hiram gets like whacked against the neck. So the neck is cut. And then the second, act is, that Hiram gets his left breast cut off and his left hand is pointing towards the sky and you have to be naked. And that's like number two. And number three is the fatal wound to the head. And I went back and I said, wow, Doyle was learning this. Doyle is a Freemason and Doyle is powerful. He's reckless. He's been in trouble multiple times. He committed humongous hoaxes. I mean, you were talking before with me about the Piltdown, but he also did a hoax where he sent up invitations to a mayor's ball, and people showed up, and there was no ball, and the police investigated him there too. And I went back, and I said, wait a minute. So let me look at the Ripper crimes again, because everybody was talking about Masonic connection because of this word Jews, J-U-W-E-S, and left on a wall in Gooston Street. But I said, wait a minute. The murder number one of Marianne Nichols, she had her neck cut and her abdomen cut. So that doesn't really fit that penal sign number one, which is the cutting of the neck, until I rethought it out. And I said, wait a minute. The Ripper cut her belly open, but then rebuttoned her dress. And she wasn't discovered to have abdominal mutilations until she went to the mortuary. So all the police saw, or any bystander saw at the time, was a neck wound, which would be penal sign number one. Then I went to the next murder, and I said, wait a minute, what happened to Ann Chapman? I said, she had her hand dipped in blood, put on her left breast, and some of her organs were placed above her shoulder. That's the second penal sign of the play Doyle was learning. And then murder number three has the neck slashing, but they think that someone must have, like, you know, was going to approach the Ripper when he was doing the crimes and fled the scene. So it wasn't carried out to completion, which is why an hour later in Mitre Square, so Long Liz was that one, and murder number three outside of a social club. Well, of course, someone's going to show up. I mean, it was outside of a social event. Murder number four is going to be the one with Catherine Eddowes, and the final blow to Hiram Abyss came as a facial wound. Well, that's what happened on murder number four. It was the only murder that was conducted with penal sign number three, which was facial mutilations. All the other ones had no knife wounds to the face. This one, he was going to actually cut off the ears. And he did nose incisions and facial wounds and eyelid lacerations. So it actually fit the Masonic ritual. And I said, oh, my God, he probably had some type of ID fix, which he actually writes about in one of his Sherlock Holmes stories, The Six Napoleons, about you see something or you get an idea and it becomes fixed in your head and you have to carry it out. And once it's over, it's done. It's like you can go on living life again. And I think that is exactly what happened with these Ripper crimes, that there was an ID fix, that you had to get this play reenacted because it was for revenge. This was a revenge play where Hiram gets killed and you get the revenge on the Jubilon and Jubella. So it shows a revenge pattern again, which goes back to those initial clues of the thimbles and the rings and the handkerchiefs that were left behind.
I mean, that's a lot to unpack, right? And as you're looking at all of this and you realize, I mean, obviously you've got some, what's the word I'm looking for here? You've got some evidence that appears to link Conan Doyle to the type of person and to the, you know, the type of knowledge that one would need to do these kind of crimes. But, you know, to take that and I can't think of what is that evidence called? Circumstantial evidence.
Circumstantial, right.
You've got some.
Yeah, unless we find the knife, you know, unless we find the knife, it's very difficult. But speaking of which, it's very interesting. I'm going to just go back and say one last thing about this. One of the pieces of evidence that I want to kind of go into the knife used. So we have to say that the Ripper was carrying a knife along with him. A pretty good one, too. Right, you need a knife to cut the abdomen, a surgical type of knife. You had to cut the neck. It has to be pretty strong. And he went from murder number three to murder number four in the same day. So he was out on the streets. You know, for an hour, he was with the entire London police force after him, the Metropolitan Police Force, the City Police Force, vigilance committees, amateur sleuths looking for, you know, to capture the Ripper. He was out there with a knife in his pocket. It's one of the things that was very interesting to me that some of the readers or listeners may find interesting is that the lodger that I mentioned before that he beat up, Brian Waller, was actually an inventor. And he was inventor of surgical knives that were foldable. I actually purchased one on eBay the other day. Not the Ripper's knife, obviously, but a knife made by Brian Waller. So it's Doyle would have had access to this brilliant inventor's material. You know, these foldable knives that you could actually use in surgery that could be, you know, a foot long, a foot and a half long, but folded back only about 6 to 9 inches long. So it was just one of those things. I said, how did the Ripper carry something? There were certain questions I asked myself, just so you know, when I was like, how did the Ripper see in the dark? You know, he, you have to be able to commit, you know, do these crimes, but you have to see what you're doing, especially eyelid mutilations. And I mentioned before, murder number four, the darkest corner, but he did an abdominal, you know, incision where he bypassed the belly button. So he obviously had to either see to do the facial mutilations or see a little bit to bypass the navel. And I had to find that answer, and I wanted to me, it was like an empty theory, like you're saying, like circumstantial evidence. But in an article Doyle wrote in the British Journal of Photography, and just so you know, Doyle was an expert photographer. I mean, he actually had a column in the British Journal of Photography before his Sherlock Holmes stories. And he actually writes that he's created a dark room using a red muslin scarf, and he would put it around his lantern. And of course, the people that were eyewitnesses to the Ripper say that he wore a red scarf around his neck. And to me, that red scarf would probably have been used as his scarf around the lantern to create a dark lamp, you know, to see in the dark. So you have to be able to see. Doyle's eyes would probably have accommodated being the expert photographer that he was, so he could carry out these murders. I mean, a guy like William Gold, the royal physician, age 72, I don't think his eyes would have adjusted. And a person that's used to working in like a barber shop, his eyes would not have been accustomed to darkness either. So these are the some of the pieces that I had to investigate myself so I could be happy with my own conclusions.
I like the concept on this, but now here's a few of the things that stand out to me. Doyle was not a slight man. He was a big guy.
Right.
Wasn't he known at that time? And wouldn't his presence in Whitechapel have been hard to hide?
I like what you're saying. Now, the person that would have been known actually would be probably Prince Albert Victor, the Duke of Clarence, who you mentioned before. Royal. Yeah, because he was royalty. And if I would have seen the royal, you know, coach around the East End, I would have been like, why is the prince about? He would have been a suspect just by that alone, but he wasn't. No one ever saw the royal coach going out, and the prince himself was up in like Balmoral in Scotland. Doyle himself was only going to get famous 3 years later. He was not known. He was an unknown writer at the time. He just had finished his first Sherlock Holmes story, A Study in Scarlet, which is a complete flop. It was not respected. No one cared about it. The second story too, Sign of the Four, flop. No one cared about it. No one read the thing. It wasn't until his third story, A Scandal in Bohemia, that Doyle became this, as he said, this celebrity guy. And if he was walking around Whitechapel, would have been, everybody would have been like, oh my God, it's Arthur Conan Doyle. He's a celebrity, but not in 1888. He would have been as unknown as me walking around Whitechapel.
All right, good to know. But again, he cut a pretty impressive swath. I mean, no, there were people that claimed to have seen him. Does his physical representation match up at all with the eyewitness accounts?
Yes, actually, they do. The facial features, the mustache, the hairline, these things were described. They actually match. I wish I could show you a photo, but they actually match Conan Doyle's. Not only that, the accoutrements that he wore, the navy coat. I mean, Doyle was a sealer in the Arctic. He would have had the navy coat. The red scarf, he actually describes himself as wearing a red scarf around his neck to his aunts and uncles when he was doing a visit to London. And that again goes, and speaking of this visit to London, that was one of the things that really got me also, was a lot of the suspects would have never been able to get around as well as Doyle had around the East End. You need to know that area. It's a little bit confusing. Doyle spent a lot of time in London, and he actually spent a lot of time down on the docks. And the docks are in the East End. And he actually writes about this, that he actually wanted to go away. He did, you know, he did the trip to the Arctic, which took, that went out of the northern part of Scotland in Aberdeen. But he also wanted to go to Brazil. He loved going down to the docks. He actually thought about running away to Brazil at one point. And he spent a lot of time down there. He knew that area. And Doyle, I don't know if a lot of your readers know or your listeners know, but he would go on long walks. And when I mean a long walk, I don't mean like a 5-mile walk and call it a day. He was doing 30-mile walks. He was known for this. Even as a child, he was known to go on 30 mile walks. If he says he went on a walk of the East End at age 17 and 16, he didn't mean he went through a 1 mile walk. He probably walked himself everywhere in the East End. He walked every single street, nook and cranny of that. He knew the place cold, which is a little bit shows you how amazing he is as far as covering up his tracks. He's on record saying that he's never walked down Baker Street in his life in the 1920s when they asked him about Sherlock Holmes, and he went to Madame Tussauds Museum, which was on Baker Street at the time when he went, and he said he needed a map when he was writing his Sherlock Holmes stories, but he actually did work over for a company where he was doing physicals, and he knew the East End and that area of the Poultry cold. His aunts and uncles lived there. He knew the place. It doesn't make any sense for what he says. You know, he walked around to Westminster Abbey, and he describes his entire visit, and he does it multiple times. He says, "I did it again." Like, he knows the place.
That's nuts. I mean, it's mind-blowing to have this concept floated out there, right? And I'm just curious. I mean, obviously, a lot of people have bandied about some theories and ideas. If you took what you had and information and brought it to a current court of law to examine, how confident are you that with, even though the evidence is circumstantial, how confident are you that this would be something that would engage a court to open a case on Conan Doyle?
As far as my research and what I found, I'm very confident, 100%, that they would listen. The problem is that I have a dual life here. I love Sherlock Holmes. I love the stories, which means I enjoy the author of the stories. I'm a fan of his as far as Sherlock Holmes. As far as the man, I find him to be, sociopathic. He has criminal behaviors behind him for other things. It's kind of like an example would be Ernest Hemingway. I love Ernest Hemingway. Great author. They have a TV show about him right now. But I would never want to go to a bar with him because I wouldn't know if I was going to come out dead or alive. I mean, it's the same type of situation. I love the works that Arthur Conan Doyle left behind, but the man he was is not the person I would want to be connected with. So I think if I could give a psychological analysis to the courts on Arthur Conan Doyle, they would listen to me. If I said, just to go out there, I think he's the man, they may say, "You mean the author of Sherlock Holmes?" No.
Right.
What are you, crazy? The guy's a knight. You know, like the guy, the knight of the empire. No, he's not the Ripper. But then if you go through all the things that happened to him, you think about, this is a child of a dysfunctional family. He was beaten. He was beaten by his family members. He was beaten by his teachers. He was all the way through his education. This is a man who had no money. He was picked on, who had to tell stories in school just for food, who the teachers would tell him, you may become a civil engineer, Doyle, but you'll never be civil. And that was on his way out of high school. I mean, having these fights, going for his examination. Now, you got to ask yourself, would you ever do this? Take an examination for your medical boards and pickpocket your examiner on the way out. There's not a chance. He did. He actually confesses to pickpocketing his examiner so he could have money on his trip as he's walking out of the room. I mean, the things he gets upset at the captain on the Arctic voyage because he wasn't allowed to go off the ship and have a fight at the Queen Anne tavern. You know, he jumps off a boat when he's in Africa and swims with sharks. Nothing about him seems normal. He goes to visit his cousins in Ireland, and he pretends to be part of the land league that was going to steal your house. He climbs up a water pipe, two stories, and dives through the window only to find a gun barrel at his head. Look, he didn't have his brains blown out, if you ask me.
Right, right.
I mean, this is not a normal person. I don't think if I were a 20-year-old kid, I would have done that. And as a 20-year-old doing, as a 20-year-old assistant physician in Birmingham, I definitely would not have sent out fake invitations to the mayor's ball and have everybody show up and then have the police come to my employer's house and say, your medical assistant sent fake letters to everybody in the social, you know, social setting to come to a ball that didn't exist. And he basically
yeah,
had
that's,
to be
that's good old fashioned.
I love it. Oh, I love it too. But yeah. I said, I don't, I just don't think I would have, I just can't see myself as a physician student, like doing these things. I just, he also, or one that I found that's in the book is that he forced his transcripts. He only did a couple of years of medical school. He never finished, but in order to finish, he must have broke into the bursary's office and put himself down for courses. Because he says he was in Birmingham doing these courses in 1877 and 1878. It's on his transcript, but he never went to Birmingham until 1879. So he actually broke into the school record room and forged dates and grades for himself. I mean, this to me, as a you know, I was a medical student once too. I wouldn't have that in me to do this. And these are just some of the things that got me going. In the beginning of my research, before I even made this connection about the syphilis and the Masonic connections to the Ripper crimes. So this is way before that part.
So in your mind, you have no doubt that Sir Arthur Conan Doyle is the Ripper.
Yeah, and to tell you the truth, I tried to exonerate my hero writer from the start. That's why I said, I mean, I know he's not a Mason, so he's obviously not the Ripper, and then sure enough, he is. And it's at the exact time that I needed him to be. You know, oh, he couldn't have done this because he doesn't have the strength to do it. And then I find out he's a boxer, he was in street gangs, he was in the Arctic, and he was the strongest. Everything I wanted to say he wasn't, he was. He had all of the characteristics that are required to become a serial killer with the strength, the bellicosity, the power, the knowledge. I mean, I love what Sherlock Holmes has in the book. When a doctor does go wrong, he is the worst of criminals. He has the knowledge and he has the nerve. I mean, it's exactly what he was. He was a doctor who went wrong. He had the knowledge and he had the nerve to carry it out. And that's actually in The Speckled Den. It's actually his favorite story. But that's what he writes.
Yeah, that's holy cow. What a wild ride. Now, listen, folks, we've barely even scratched. There's so much detail and so much interesting facts in this book that you need to pick it up. You need to examine it for yourself because it's again, I love when we can challenge a paradigm that we believed for a long time and to suddenly throw in a name like Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, who seems above the possibility of this and suddenly be shining a spotlight on it. That's crazy. It's exciting to have something new to consider. The Strange Case of Dr. Doyle, A Journey into Madness and Mayhem. We do have a link up for the book in today's program guide. Out of all that you uncovered and that you looked into, why do you think more people haven't written about this darker side of Doyle?
I will tell you, I'm also a writer of a lot of articles about Arthur Conan Doyle and about Sherlock Holmes. He is a man that is respected. He is one of the most brilliant writers ever. His characters are immortal. I mean, when you watch TV, there's Sherlock, there's Elementary. There are movies with Robert Downey Jr. in them. I mean, people, I'll say me, I love his creations. It's kind of hard for me to say and to actually, it's almost an unimaginable even to me that my hero could be this person. I don't even want to believe it, but unfortunately I have to. But there are others out there that will say, no, I don't care what you want to present to me and what you want to show to me and what you say. I don't agree with anything that you're talking about. As a matter of fact, I wrote an article in a journal, a very respected journal on why Sherlock Holmes went to Tibet. And I got people writing me, this is nonsense, this is garbage. It was other people saying it was the greatest article they've ever read. Other people say, but then they put a post up on, he's the guy who wrote The Strange Case of Dr. Doyle. And that alone got people to go anti what I say.
Right.
Even though my research I don't want to publish anything if my research can be, you know, discredited. It would be embarrassing. And right. And then when, you know, but they see that and they go, well, you attacked Doyle. That you cannot do that. And I can understand that. I mean, yes, there are societies dedicated to the man.
Right.
I mean, he's a knight of the empire for his propaganda work in South Africa. He didn't get it for Sherlock Holmes. He got it for his work in South Africa. You know, why should we go to war in South Africa? So that's why he got it. But yeah, if I were them, I would say, yeah, you attacked our hero. You can't. I mean, you just can't. It's like Bill. When I first learned that Bill Cosby was being arrested for sex, I said, "No, the guy who did Fat Albert. No, it's impossible.
Right. He's
innocent." And I'm sure the same thing must have been when Abraham Lincoln got shot, and they said this famous actor killed the president. I am certain there are people out there saying, "No, not John Wilkes Booth. He's from a family of actors. He would never have done such a thing, and he did." You can't believe it, but they have. I mean, another famous writer was homicidal. I mean, I think if you go to Wikipedia, they say that Rudyard Kipling, the guy who wrote The Jungle Book, they say the same thing. He was like he was homicidal for a time, but didn't kill anybody. But you can see, if you talk nasty about your hero, you are going to attack. And that is what I'm going to get. And that's why I don't think so many people want to investigate Arthur Conan Doyle's, you know, work with the Ripper crimes. I think he, you know, you try to put your hero in a pedestal and you don't want to attack him.
Did you ever take it further? Did you look at any of the places Conan Doyle visited and spent time? Were there any strange murders that were Ripper-like any other point in his life?
You know, there's one that I suspect that he did. Well, obviously the one with his almost brother-in-law, Jack Hawkins, John Hawkins, that one was, he actually writes about it in I believe it's in the Stark Monroe letters, where he says, "I accidentally gave too much chlorohydrate and he didn't wake up in the morning. And he buried him." And that is a true story, actually. If you look into his history, that the police actually did come to his house. So that one people already know about. But the other one that catches me a little bit, and I didn't investigate this one, was that he had a friend in medical school by the name of George T. Budd. And George Budd, he writes about in his autobiography, Memories and Adventures, that he died in middle age from a cerebral hemorrhage. Really, really odd was the fact that he was only like 31 years old at the time when he died. He wasn't middle age, and there is speculated that he actually sent money back to the family after his death. It's just kind of weird that death took place, you know, 2 months after the Ripper's crime spree. And I, as I said, I didn't investigate this one. It wasn't on my radar, but as you asked me this question, it's one that I'm wondering, I wonder if he had, maybe there was a cerebral hemorrhage, kind of odd, or was there something else going on? There seems to be nothing in the man's history that anybody died at these early ages, especially in the early 30s.
Fascinating stuff. Doctor, thank you so much for jumping on and sharing some insights into this case with us.
Oh, it's an absolute pleasure. I really enjoy this.
A Strange Case of Dr. Doyle, A Journey into Madness and Mayhem. Get the book, read it. I'd love to hear from you guys. What do you think about this? Again, we've got to lift the veil of fame and examine this for what it is. Do these pieces of evidence, does this story add up to you? I'd love to hear from you. DaveAtDarknessRadio.com. Email me. And remember, once you've read the book, make sure to rate and review, because it's always good for the authors to get more exposure on this as well. All right. It's time now to kick open the case files. Dumb crimes and stupid criminals.
It's Crayon News story time.
What happened with this dude, Christ Bearer? I heard he cut his penis off and then jumped off a balcony.
Suspect pulls gun from butt, shoots twice at Denver police.
What is your emergency?
I need help.
And what's the problem?
I'm too high.
You're too high?
Yeah.
All right, dumb crime, stupid criminals. Tim, we've been starting off with a nice kick recently. I like doing kind of hero stories, the other side of the coin.
Yep.
And we're going to give Florida their due again. We've got another hero story from Florida this week.
Really?
This time, a 7-year-old boy who swam for an hour to get help for his dad and sister stranded in a river.
Wow.
Yeah, that's right. A 7-year-old boy in Florida is being hailed a hero after he swam ashore to get help when his sister and dad got swept away by the current. Stephen Pouse told CNN affiliate WJXT, Tim, the Jixt, that he anchored his boat on the St. John's River in Jacksonville, Florida, let his two children, Chase, 7, and Abigail, 4, swim on Friday. All of a sudden, Abigail, who usually hangs out at the back of the boat, had to let go because the current was so strong, Chase said. The 7-year-old decided to also let go in order to try to keep her from drifting, but then he was stuck. Pouse jumped in to try to help them and told Chase to swim to shore while he tried to reach his daughter, who was wearing a life jacket. I told them I loved him because I wasn't sure what's going to happen, Pouse said. I tried to stick with both of them. I wore myself out. She drifted away. It took Chase an hour to get to shore. He told WJXT that he floated on his back and then would flip over and doggy paddle so he wouldn't wear himself out. When he finally reached land, he ran to the nearest house for help. Meanwhile, his dad and sister drifted about a mile and a half to 2 miles away from the boat's location, according to Jacksonville Fire and Rescue Department. JFRD reached the boat but had to call in other agencies to expand the search, spokesperson Eric Proswimmer said. Really? Pro swimmer? Are you kidding me in a story like this? In a news conference, if it wasn't for the help of his colleagues and the outcome, it could have been very different, Pro Swimmer said. We had every resource we could have possibly had coming quickly, and we're happy to say all three have been recovered. All three are safe and doing well. We couldn't ask for a better outcome. How do you like that? Pro Swimmer is the spokesperson for this. Dude, when you see this picture, the dad looks like he's in relatively good shape. The little girl, very small. Mm-hmm. You can understand how she could get swept away, how the father got swept away. But the 7-year-old boy, who's just like a foot taller than his little sister, he managed to make it to shore and swam for an hour to get there. I also have this question. And I'm not meaning to make Mr. Stephen Pouse put underneath the gun, but who swims in a lake in Florida, especially allowing two little niblets to swim? Aren't there alligators in basically every water source in Florida?
Yeah, but you know, when you live in Florida, gators are like mosquitoes. They're just, I think you don't
dude,
take
no,
them.
There's no way I could do that. Oh,
you don't
man.
Take them as seriously as like we do. Like the first few times I went down to Florida, I was like, oh my God, there's a gator. Now when I see one float in the canal, I go, oh look, there's a gator.
Yeah, but you wouldn't get in the canal, and you certainly wouldn't send one of your children or nephews and nieces into the canal.
No, I wouldn't let them get close to the canal. You know, to me, it's like the scare factor of them isn't, or the fear factor of them is not as high as it used to be.
Mm.
You just get used to seeing them. It's like I'm trying to think of something equivalent here in Minnesota, like a wolf here in Minnesota. I don't know, or a bobcat. I don't know how often you've seen a bobcat out in the woods. But I've seen plenty of them, and or when you hear wolves, you go, oh geez, there's a wolf close to here.
I just pulled it up just to take a look. Here's a recent information on it. The St. John's River, from the Buckman Bridge to Fuller Warren Bridge, biologists counted a little over 108 alligators while conducting their study, which is only 14% of the estimated population. So there's really an estimated 771 alligators living within that 13-mile stretch of water.
Oh, is that all?
771. Would you think, and I'm not trying to cause trouble for this guy, maybe I am, reckless endangerment. Who the flip pulls your boat over to let him swim in gator-infested water?
Yeah, that's not a smart move.
Wow. Seriously, that would be something I would be more concerned about. But how two of them floated down the river for 2 miles. The other one swam an hour by himself like a little Cheerio floating in the water for these gators, and he made it. That's amazing. God was watching over this family, Tim. That's all I got to say.
I don't want to say anything ignorant.
Right.
But I don't know what the ratio is of gator attacks to humans. I really don't. You know?
Man, they eat animals constantly.
They do, but it's smaller animals.
Right, but these and are little children, kids. If you saw the size of these little kids.
They do go. They do go after children and smaller children, but mm-hmm. I don't know that there's an age limit. Like, they're not carting children to see how old they are if they're going to eat them. But I don't know what, you know, like. I mean, obviously, there's a size where they stop attacking, you know. I don't deal with gators on a daily basis, so I couldn't tell you. I'm not exactly the gator guy or anything like that, so I couldn't tell you. I can't speak. I'm not an expert on that.
That's nuts. It's nuts. I don't care. Still, you don't know how big the gators are there too. You don't know. There could be a 12 footer, you know, some massive mm-hmm. prehistoric creature. I don't know. Well, here's a story that explains to you why Tim and I shave our own heads. A barber has been charged with murdering a customer who refused to pay for his haircut. That's right. A barber from suburban Chicago has been charged with murder for allegedly shooting and killing a customer who refused to pay for his haircut. The deadly incident took place around 4 p.m. last Thursday at the Studio 914 Barbershop at 914 South Fifth Avenue in Chicago. Deshaun McDory, 40, owner of the business, was arrested, charged with first-degree murder in connection with the killing of a 31-year-old Christian McDougald. McDory's business charges around $15 for a haircut, and it's unclear why he and McDougald came to blows over McDougald's new look. McDory's, what a weird set of names, McDory and McDougald. McDory's business partner, 43-year-old Samuel Williams, was also arrested on the charge of unlawful use of a weapon by a felon for being in possession of multiple guns, reported the Chicago Sun-Times. Cook County Assistant State's Attorney Kevin Meehan said that McDougald refused to pay for a haircut and began arguing with McDory and the other barbers. According to the barbershop's Facebook page, again, men's haircuts are only between $15 to $25. As the dispute escalated, McDougald allegedly followed McDory to the back door of the barbershop, where the barber shot the irate customer twice in the chest, killing him. Yikes. Over a $15 to $25 haircut.
Yeah, it's
I got nothing on that. I mean, it's just like, I don't know. I got nothing.
Maybe he would have been better off just staying home and bicking the thing himself.
Yeah. Well, and now here's my next story, Tim, proving why I don't talk to my neighbors, because you just never know what's going to set off a neighbor. And it is Iowa for this next story, I should say. Iowa man has been arrested for allegedly setting fire to his neighbor's house because, well, they didn't mow his lawn for him after he asked them to the previous day. Lee Bowman, 53, arrested on Sunday following an incident on the same day in Sioux City, Iowa, and has since been charged with first-degree arson and second-degree criminal mischief, according to a report by the Sioux City Police Department obtained by the CBS Siouxland News. Bowman admitted that he was upset on Sunday that his neighbors had not cut his grass after he asked them to do so. The authorities have not yet revealed why Bowman wanted his neighbors to mow the lawn. The 53-year-old visited his neighbor's house on Sunday to ask why they had not cut his grass and was filmed on home surveillance footage attempting to take a registration ticket or sticker off of one of their vehicles. The neighbors were alerted to the fire later in the day when another local resident who had called the authorities banged on the door to inform them of the blaze. They managed to escape without any injuries.
I was going to say that vacant stare I was telling you about when I was doing radio in Iowa. Some of the townsfolk, actually most of the townsfolk in this town I was working in, had it. I imagine that's kind of what this guy probably had.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Freaky.
Yeah.
The neighbors were alerted to the fire. The police said the local fire department received a report of a blaze at about 6 p.m. They managed to put it out. The corner of the house was burned in the fire with about $3,000 worth of damages. Well, that's not bad for a house fire.
Houses are cheap in Iowa. You can
oh God.
Well, they are. You can. I think you can probably get a good house for $50,000 in Iowa. Just so about
almost one tenth of the value of the house. Yeah. All right. Well, the police department were told by the Sioux City Fire and Rescue that the fire was intentionally started as they found plywood and sticks propped up by the house alongside a fuel accelerant. The 53-year-old is currently being held in the Woodbury County Jail. How much do you think your bond is in Iowa for trying to set fire to your neighbor's house while they're in it?
Well, it only costs you like $50,000 to build a new one. So, I'll go $500.
$20,000.
Oh, well.
In nearby Ohio on Monday afternoon, a man was arrested and accused of fatally shooting a woman in an apartment building before stealing a car and setting a separate house on fire. Good grief. A big fire time. I don't know why everybody's all into this fire stuff. Neighbors told local media they saw the man leave the burning house on Monday engulfed by flames while shouting that he wanted to die. Well, then you don't leave the house. That's the worst way to kill yourself. It's like handing Tim poison and making him drink it. And then I go, I just want to die. I should have been the one to drink it, I'm guessing.
Yeah. Yeah.
Mr. Florida. That's right. Tim, Mr. Florida has been accused of a crime spree in Zephyrhills. Zephyrhills police have arrested a man they believe is responsible for robbing several businesses. Police say early Sunday morning, a man identified as Lawrence Franklin King, Florida. That's right. His real name is Mr. Florida. Stole everything from alcohol to pet medication. Among the businesses he's accused of robbing is Little Cat Rescue, a nonprofit that helps stray and abandoned animals. The owner says she woke up to find cats running in her front yard. I went out there. There were just cats out in the front yard. And I thought, oh my gosh, what's going on? And I look over the facility and I see the door wide open. When my heart just drops, says Desiree Angel Ballard. She then went into the building where she keeps her cats and found items strewn everywhere. Everything there on the top shelf had gone over there on the floor. All the meds were all over the place, said Ballard, who believes the thief was after pet medication she stores for her cats. He took cat pain medication and some dewormer. Getting high on a little kitty uppers and kitty downers. And, well, just for a good measure, I'm going to deworm myself. He will be tapeworm free for the next year, she said. She was then shocked when detectives told her who they think is responsible for the break-in. Ballard says Lawrence, Florida, lived across the street from her at one time and even volunteered at the Little Cat Rescue. The Lawrence, Florida they told me about is not the one. That's not him, said Ballard. So there's two Larry Floridas, Tim.
Unbelievable.
One must be the evil twin. Police believe Florida also broke into Massey Barbershop, where he stole hair clippers. He's also accused of breaking into Lisa's barbershop and stealing two pairs of scissors. Police said that they believe he also broke into the carpet and floor store, the Living Foods Bakery, and Cafe Zephyrhills Veterinary Clinic, and the Great Catch Restaurant, where the owners say he stole beer and White Claw. We have a black gate that he entered through, and there's a large cooler that holds our beer, and he took 27 cases of beer down to the ditch and dumped it into the ditch, said George Ellis, who can't explain why Florida took the White Claw. He took it to the next door to the mobile home park and left it there, said Ellis, who says Florida worked for him at one time. Lawrence, he used to work for me last year. He was here for about 8 months. He was a cook in the kitchen. During a post-Miranda interview with officers, police say Florida admitted to breaking into all the above listed locations and agreed to walk officers around to where he dumped the stolen items. Your Honor, Dave Schrader, Tim Dennis, defense attorneys at law here, Mr. Florida, would like to approach the bench. I think this case should be dismissed as Mr. Florida was brought up believing he owned the state. His family talked to him about this, and because his last name is Florida, living in the state of Florida, you can understand the confusion. Being the owner of a state would make you believe that you do have full access to every one of the locations that you've entered and that the items must be yours since you own the state. So, Your Honor, it's clear this case needs to be thrown out. I rest my case. I said good day, sir. I said good day.
And on a sidebar, Your Honor, let's face it, White Claw is garbage. So he just threw it in the ditch.
Yeah, he dumped it. He knew what he was doing. He was saving those people from drinking White Claw.
Yeah.
Today's episode is brought to you by White Claw.
Oh gosh, sorry. Oops. I didn't mean to say that.
Oh, good grief. Okay, here we go. This is a weird story. A British man saw his drug empire crumble after he was caught handling a very different product, a fine blue cheese, Tim. Oh, that's right. 39-year-old Carl Stewart from Liverpool used an encrypted network to share a photograph of himself holding a small block of the Marks & Spencer's Sultan. The network was more commonly used for drugs and was being watched by international police. As part of the Operation Venetic, a crack team of cyber cops were able to extract his fingerprints from the photo and identify him. That discovery led police to a rich vein of illegal drugs and saw Stewart jailed for 13 years on charges of conspiracy to supply cocaine, heroin, MDMA, and ketamine. Stewart used the nickname Toffee Force. Worst drug dealer name ever. What are you in for? Drugs. Wow, drugs. What's your name? They call me Toffee Force. I'm sorry. They call me Toffee Force. He boasted a global membership of about 60,000 people. After the sentencing last week at Liverpool Crown Court, Detective Inspector Lee Wilkinson said Stewart was caught out by his love of Stilton cheese. Blue cheese is horrible, Tim.
Oh, my God.
Understand it? It's scented weird. It tastes horrible. It tastes as I would imagine licking between your toes would feel, Tim.
Yes. Okay. So may I for just
A
minute here? Okay. So my family has this unnatural love of blue cheese, and I have not subscribed to that at all. Okay. So we get together this weekend for my uncle's birthday. All right. And the one thing my uncle and I have in common, thank God, he's my godfather. We're exactly 20 years apart. He does not like blue cheese either. So the entire time there's a salad at dinner, and they, for some reason, now I'm going to give you a dressing here that's going to absolutely make you retch. Other people are going to write in and say they think that this is the best dressing they've ever heard of. Now, there's a grocery store here in town called Lund's and Byerly's, okay? They're a combined grocery store chain. They have managed to put into one jar, it's of their own making, a combination of, are you ready for this, Dave? French and blue cheese dressing mixed together in one jar. I know. I call this the apocalypse. It is, to me, wretched. They should store it near the motor oil and the antifreeze because it's probably hazardous material. So I'm just like, why don't I just take off my crow walker boot and shred my callus over your lettuce? It's probably gross. The same shit. It's the same shit, right?
Yeah. I don't know, and I never want to find out.
Because it's just, to me, blue cheese is like, it's like feet. That's what it is. It's like feet. It's like feet. It's feet fungus, right?
Right.
And French dressing is no better. But now,
I have to disagree with you. I like French dressing.
Ugh.
But blue cheese, no thank you.
But now they've taken the worst of the worst, and they've combined it so you can have an even worse taste put
Maybe
together.
They cancel each other out.
And as my, And then as my uncle put it, why don't you just have a nice Caesar salad? Why don't you just use a nice ranch dressing? What's wrong with you people?
A lot of people don't like ranch. Ranch can be stinky and gross too, but I happen to be a fan of ranch. Not the ranch Doritos. Those are too stinky, but I like ranch.
Just a nice buttermilk ranch. A homemade buttermilk ranch is very nice. You know?
This is brought to you by Hidden Valley. A former Southwest Airline pilot pleaded guilty on Friday to a federal charge of committing a lewd, indecent, or obscene act mid-flight while he was the pilot in command. That's right. After the August 10th, 2020 flight from Philadelphia to Orlando reached cruising altitude, Michael Hack, age 60, of Longwood, Florida, admitted to removing his clothes in the cockpit of the plane and exposing himself to his female first officer. He then proceeded to view pornographic material in the cockpit on his laptop as the plane continued its flight. This guy joined the solo Mile High Club, Tim.
I guess so.
As the plane continued its flight, Hack further engaged in inappropriate conduct in the cockpit. Where else would you do things like that? It's a confusing title. As the first officer continued to perform her duties as an assigned air crew member, federal prosecutors in Maryland said, according to Hack's plea agreement, he had never met the female officer prior to the flight. Hack was sentenced to 1 year probation in order to pay $5,000. A Southwest spokesperson said that Hack left the airline before the company was made aware of the incident. Oh, God. How did he quit before your co-pilot said, oh, by the way, today's landing went really well. Everything was fine. Flight was good. And my the lead pilot masturbated furiously naked in his seat to online porn.
He took his eyes off the ball and put her in autopilot.
Oh, I don't think he took his eyes off the ball. That's the problem. He was staring right at it, Tim.
Well, there's that, too.
Oh, yeah. My God. How bizarre. How bizarre. That's it for this week's Dumb Crimes, Stupid Criminals. We'll be back again next week. Our good friend Alan Warren joins us. Murder Times 6, the true story of the Wells Gray Park murders. That's next week right here on True Crime Tuesday.